You're in tune to KZSU Stanford. It's time for another edition of Raising Sand.
My life is still trying to get up that great big hill of hope.
Welcome to another edition of Raising Sand Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, and today we'll hear from Diane Benson, who is running for the U.S. House of Representatives for the state of Alaska. We'll also hear from Mark Canham, the father of Dustin Canham, a young Marine who died under suspicious circumstances during a routine peacekeeping operation in the African country of Djibouti. Joining me first on the phone from Alaska is Diane Benson, the Democratic candidate running for the U.S. House of Representatives for the state of Alaska against longtime Representative Don Young. I asked Diane to describe her candidacy and what makes her different.
I am running for the U.S. House of Representatives in the state of Alaska, which has one representative seat in Congress, and which is rather significant since it's been held by the same person for 35 years. I'm the only person who has ever run against him and shook him up a great deal on very little money and actually goaded him into a public, televised, primetime debate. That's never happened. I ran against our incumbent, Don Young, in 2006. I won the primary, which at that time had five men that were running, most of them not with any kind of seriousness. A lot of people run because they want to push certain issues, and I got over 40% of the vote, which was really unheard of, especially on so little money. My total campaign amount at that time was $200,000 for both the primary and general combined.
Oh, congratulations.
And it was
been a shock for Don Young and Alaska in general.
Yes, it was. And because I have never had any political ambition to speak of and have never held public office, per se, I was not taken seriously by many of the pundits. Needless to say, they took me quite serious on election night when the numbers came in and I had received over 40% of the vote.
Mm.
The effort was totally grassroots, and it was about speaking to people and with the message that the people should be represented rather than lobbyists and large corporate interests.
And that, does that tend to be the case in Alaska?
I would say so. It certainly resonated with people, and which is why I ran on partially on that message. But I also ran as the mother of a wounded warrior regarding the Iraq War, and we have a large military population up here as well as a large veteran population, and considering the fact that 5.5 months before my son, before I filed for office, which was late in April of 2006, my son was injured. He was injured November 13th, 2005, 13 days after he had completed his four-year commitment.
He'd been stop-lost?
He was stop-lost, yes.
Okay.
And he did want out, but he wasn't about to abandon his fellow soldiers either, which is very typical. But 13 days after that date, he was injured by a bomb, lost both of his legs and other injuries to his body. The worst thing I think a mother or any parent would ever have to hear is, you know, that kind of call from DOD or worse. And but he's been, my son has been very impressive in his, like many of them are, in his handling of the loss of his legs and going on with life, and which is part of what motivated me to run. because our incumbent hadn't even bothered to visit any of our wounded at Walter Reed Army Medical. And I know what the distance is and the means of transportation between the Capitol and Walter Reed Army Medical. So it's quite easy to get over there, but he never did.
Mm. And Alaska has presented a lot of warriors to the war. They have the striker brigades up there, don't they?
That's correct. We've had quite a few losses in recent months, particularly in this past year. And it's been very, very difficult for Army families and National Guard that have been deployed from here.
Diane, talk a little more about that in terms of the military families, how they're viewing the war at this point. I know that there's been some friction between the folks that really, quote-unquote, support the troops unconditionally and the folks like yourself who support the troops and believe that they need better treatment. Is there still a lot of friction going on with that?
Well, most people feel that our troops need better treatment. I mean, when I tell people that we've got troops who are facing their sixth deployment, they're stunned.
Yeah.
That's how severe it is in what I termed the abuse of our military. And I serve on the military committee for the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce, and I'm also a member of MFSO, and I was more active back when my son was still serving with that. He's now in the VA system, but I've also been very involved with our veterans up here, and on top of it, I'm now a member of the Ladies Auxiliary of the VFW from Bethel, and which is kind of an interesting thing for someone like me to be a part of such a patriotic group. But the thing of it is that I'm able to talk about it because of the kind of credentials that I carry in the form of being a mother of a wounded warrior. And it is not about exploiting my son, because that would be just wrong. It's really about taking care of our wounded like him. It is about taking care of our military families who are overextended and exhausted from this war. And it is about the high human and economic cost of this war that we cannot sustain or afford. And therefore, I'm able to talk about that and to military or to groups like the VFW and other veterans. And because I care so passionately about them, and at the same time, and understand the need for warriors in our society, but I also don't believe that a preemptive war is ever a solution, that those who have seen the ravages of war rarely choose war as a first solution, and this administration has, and I think has done so without a lot of consideration, or maybe much consideration at all, about what they are asking of us and those who serve and those who are family members of those who serve.
I'm just looking at the website, Benson for Congress, and I'm looking at your endorsers, and you have Senator Max Cleland who's endorsed you. He says, "I have watched this family take tragedy in their lives and turn it around. It is Diane and her son's continued strength to persevere that constantly oppresses me. Diane is one courageous woman."
Me like Max.
Yeah, Max Cleland knows certainly what your son has gone through.
I met him at Walter Reed Army Medical. He was profoundly compassionate. And given how difficult it was for us at that time, when my son was still in Ward 57, which is the amputee ward primarily, it was really helpful to have will always feel indebted to him for that.
Talking about Ward 57, I actually visited there in 2004 and talked with some of the folks that had been injured. And there was really a very nice atmosphere in that place. I mean, despite what people were going through, I could see the pain it was to try and rehabilitate. But there were actually several vets from Vietnam there who were themselves amputees that would come in every day or several times a week and talk to the troops and boost them and, you know, let them know that life goes on after this and, you know, show them the ropes, more or less.
Oh, there's wonderful people who, whether they're new amputees or amputees from previous times, who have been very supportive to families there and to, and there's a lot of groups, too, that really dedicate themselves to helping out. And, you know, in that way, I think the community has really stepped forward to assist. The problem becomes later when they get out of places like, you know, and in a way Walter Reed's kind of like a fishbowl. Everybody was going there for a while. I mean, even Cher made her visit there. And my son had all kinds of celebrity visitors that came to him. They were almost overwhelmed by it. But it's when they leave and go back to trying to live day to day and they become part of the VA system, it becomes very difficult then. You don't have that same kind of excitement around you and distraction.
Then it's just you and your history that you have to create a new future for.
And my son and his wife, and he's lucky because he's got a wonderful wife who has been by his side through everything. But there's a lot of work involved, you know, for these spouses who live with somebody who's an amputee or for family members. Like, I met a young girl who's an amputee. She was there at the same time my son was, and she only had her mother, you know, and I don't think she was even 20 years old. And now she's an amputee and having to learn to live life with that adjustment, and I think it was a greater adjustment for her mother.
Mm. Yeah, I must say that I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and we have a group here called Swords to Plowshares that works with vets, predominantly up until recently with vets from Vietnam. But we also have a lot of homeless people here, and a large proportion of the homeless people are vets. And I think that speaks to what you're saying here. The family structure becomes extremely important when someone is injured or psychologically damaged by war. And it's very important, I think, for the families to just keep very clear that they need to put all of their attention that they can into their loved one, because the VA system is really struggling.
It is. Part of the challenge is, too, that there are a lot of veterans, and I think there are many who become homeless who do not have the family support that my son has enjoyed.
Exactly, yeah.
And, you know, without that family support, who do they have? And they have to rely on a system or the kindness of others, and sometimes it's not there, and it might be there only for a short time. The challenges are really great for us as communities across the nation. And how we handle the disabled overall, let alone and make, you know, places, public places accessible. Just that one aspect of care, and to me it is part of care, is to have accessibility, whether, you know, to places. I remember at one point having to carry, it took a couple people to try to carry my son up some stairs with the wheelchair to get into a restaurant.
Mm.
But you don't think about those things, I think, and now as communities across the nation, we really must think about it, not just because of this war, but this war is certainly making it visible what the costs are.
Well, even in a place like Fairbanks, it's not that easy, is it, to get around with a wheelchair?
No, and certainly not in the wintertime, which is a good part of the year, too. Those are the kinds of things that motivate me and drive me, you know, is how we best prepare for their return, how we best help communities and communities become, I think, more supportive to those in need. And the needs are going to be great on many levels. There are social issues that come with returning vets. You have not just the social issues that aren't thought about too much, but the TBI, the traumatic brain injuries or the mild traumatic brain injury issues that need attention but that often aren't diagnosed or are overlooked for too long, families and communities that need to be prepared, what some of those symptoms are so that they can respond. And that's a lot of work. And I brought that stuff up while my son was still over there because I was familiar with post-traumatic stress disorder and was talking to our healthcare groups here. And I say groups because we have TRICARE, which is with the Army and so on, that the service members buy into. There's also the private sector and the government sectors besides, and in this state it's the Tribal Health Consortium and so on, that all of these groups could work together to help ease this transition with these returning warriors and assist their families. And post-traumatic stress disorder is a huge part of that, dealing with that, which is why I talk about some of the social impacts, you know, whether it's domestic violence or alcohol and drug abuse, that kind of thing, or even issues around suicide. This state has a lot of issues around suicide.
Oh, yes, does
it? As it is. And then you compound it with this. And so it means get ready. Communities, get ready. Everyone, get ready. And don't just go shopping as a way to deal with this war. I mean, we do, you know, it's taking care of your families and your neighbors and making sure that our representation is active on their behalf.
I want to remind our listeners that we're talking with Diane Benson, running for U.S. House as a representative from Alaska. And, Diane, your platform actually has a lot of different issues that you address directly, civil rights and liberties, the economy, education, environment. All of these actually feed into the same system, don't they? The way the troops are treated when they return, even while they're in the military, reflects some of the ways we actually look at people in the society generally, doesn't it?
Well said. One of the things I bring up a great deal here is that this race is about people. That if representation isn't about people, then what is it about? And how we treat our veterans says a lot about who we are as a society, who are more vulnerable in the society overall as well, with the disabled, those who are having difficult times, whether it's economically or otherwise. How do we treat them? What kind of communities are we? Are we, in fact, being neighborly? You know, and I'd like to see the attitude shift in Congress. We've certainly seen enough people looking out for certain multinational corporate interests. I think it's time for the people's interests to be taken into the forefront.
And do you see a trend in that direction now, or are you feeling like it's going to take a lot longer?
As long as we keep electing the same good old boy network into place, even if we just change the faces, things are not truly going to change. It's been a bit of a challenge for women in this state to run for office, as it is in many places, but it's been a particular challenge here, and a Democrat woman certainly has never been elected to higher office here. It's kind of embarrassing, I feel, as a Democrat, that Republicans have managed to do that before we did. In 35 years of Don Young running and maintaining his seat in Congress, has he ever had challengers that came close to upsetting him? And they were all, interestingly enough, Native candidates, two Native candidates in the 70s, and two women. And I found that very interesting. Unfortunately, they didn't win, regardless of the money that was raised. And there was one man, one white male, who actually came very close about 18 years ago, and he came from money, and he was the former mayor of Valdez. I just think that's an interesting note. We're in a time now where it seems to be so difficult with a nation that has over 50% women to have women in Congress. We only have 16% of of Congress that are women, let alone how many of them are women of color, which are very...
Those that are, Maxine Waters, for example, Barbara Lee, are really fierce. I have so much respect for them, having seen them in action in Congress. It's quite something. So when we do get female candidates like yourself, they tend to be really strong, and they really are determined.
I think women have to be, you know, we have to prove ourselves so much more than our male counterparts seeking office, and probably in a number of leadership areas. I'm unusual anyway, so it's like, how do we even categorize me? One, I'm a woman, and one, I'm a Native American woman, and the other, I've never had any, you know, held political office before. So who am I to be running for the House of Representatives?
You're also a single parent?
Yes. Well, I was a good part of it, yes.
Yeah, so you've broken the mold in many ways.
And I'm doing very well in this campaign, regardless of all the barriers. And I think that comes from being a person who wants to represent people. And I'm not driven by any other ambition. And that also is probably unique these days. I think there are a lot of good people sometimes who go after seats, and some make it, but most of them don't. Money plays too big of a role in who ends up serving in Congress, and people begin to feel like it's just about the money and it's not about people.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I want this campaign to be clearly about people. I mean, I have a long way to go with fundraising, even though I've raised much more now than I did in 2006 at this point in time, but it's still a big struggle. It's still dealing with media that sometimes has a bias that somehow only someone who has served in the state legislature, for example, is a viable candidate over somebody who actually garnered over 40% of the vote against an incumbent and did not serve in any of public office. But I think the natural question is, and it's a legitimate question, is who am I to serve and who am I to run? And that's where I bring up several things. I'm tough enough. All we have to do is look at the environments that I've already worked in. I drove trucks for 5 years of my life, tractor trailers and concrete mixers. Those are big, heavy jobs in a man's world, and you have to be tough, not just physically, but you have to be tough in spirit in order to survive in that environment, which I did very well. I think a person has to, and, you know, understandably, the public wants someone that understands law and government and is able to articulate the needs of the people, preferably. And with my experience with Alaska Legal Services, working in public entitlement law, having been an advocate and an activist, I suppose, on a number of different issues, I've certainly proven myself there. And then it's, you know, what else does someone want to see? I think the public wants to see someone who understands them and who knows them and will take those issues to Congress. And I've lived in this state my entire life, and I pay attention to people, and I've had to live and struggle along with them through everything. I think that makes a difference in the voice that is in Congress when that person has actually had to go through the same sorts of struggles in order to survive, in order to raise a family, in order to meet the bills. And if we have only men who have not had to face those challenges, then how are those issues ever going to come to the floor? And historically, when we look at the record, generally, when it comes to women's issues, quote-unquote, which usually involves family issues, they're brought forward by women.
The way women are treated in Congress, I mean, we just saw this thing that happened with Hillary Clinton. I mean, there's a lot to take on when you go in this direction, isn't there?
Yes.
And you're not daunted by that?
No. I've been through too much. You know, seriously, I've been through a lot. One of the things that came out in the paper here that I had pretty much kept under wraps, which is an achievement all by itself, because I have been vocal about violence against women. And I've served on a number of survivor panels as a means to help other survivors and help assist them understand what they're dealing with when they are face-to-face with a survivor of sexual abuse and rape and other violence. Having done that for years and yet never having the media aware of it was probably just luck, but it finally came out in the papers about a month ago here, and it was front page news, you know, U.S. congressional candidate raped, yada yada. And it was traumatic to read that kind of headline, those kind of headlines. But I went ahead and put together a press conference to really talk about violence against women, because it is a crisis in this state, and it's a crisis in other states. I think it's a horrific aspect of our of the trends today. You know, it's almost as if we've become accustomed to accepting that these kinds of things go on, and that they only happen to people who are at-risk behavior. And the reality is that women from all walks of life, in every class and every race, there's, you know, someone being raped or beaten or whatever, and that just shouldn't be happening in a country that we say is so great and is about equality and liberty and justice.
So this came out in the local paper, or in the paper in Alaska, and you organized a press conference to just confront it right on.
I did, and as a result of it, our office was flooded with calls, and my home was flooded with calls, and we even had people who were victims who called in to ask where they could go for help. It was really overwhelming, and all it did was really affirm that just how great this problem really is. But there I am. I'm out there talking about those issues that usually no congressional candidate is ever going to talk about.
Right.
And I thought, well, this is what's in the lives of people. They're being affected by violence. They're being affected by methamphetamine that comes into their communities. They're being affected by premiums that are much too high, and yet they can't afford, they don't qualify for benefits or for certain services. And so they're stuck in the middle. And we've got families that are working three jobs, and they can never see their children because of it. And then, on the other hand, with representatives that are more concerned about how much money, you know, Exxon doesn't have to spend to pay off the Prince William Sound. You know, just the irony of these things, and not thinking about, and then talking about family values, and yet that young woman can't spend time with her children because she's working three minimum wage jobs trying to keep things afloat. And those are the things that caused me to feel outraged enough to run. So I might have started as a result of my son's injuries in this, but I've certainly gotten passionate about those who are struggling and need to see somebody who cares in a representative position.
These issues are so complex in a way, and one of your jobs is to break them down into a message that people can really grasp and understand quickly and register, you know, their own relationship to that issue. How do you do that? Do you have like a group of people that works with you to hone these messages, or is this something you sound like you're more an independent person who might come up with them herself? I mean, how do you work that?
In my campaign, it's been a lot on me, but this time around, I also have a lot of consultants who are going to be playing a big role here shortly. In the meantime, part of my soundbite messages, if you will, are I want to bring some sanity and humanity back to Congress.
Mm. You just kind of take it in small chunks?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because, most people, they need to hear it in simple terms in this day and age. But it's bottom line issues. It's taking care of our veterans. And in a state like ours with that high population, that matters. And being able to say it with some authority, which I can, is health care, which is huge in this state as it is everywhere. So many people without the benefit of health care. So that always comes up. Our resources and the development of our resources, my message there is let's do it responsibly, not just responsibly in the economic sense, which I believe means Alaskans must benefit from their own resources, which I bring up as a big issue, and people, that certainly resonates here, but that we also have jobs, the key jobs out of it, that we also have a backyard that is not marred by the development to the point that we don't want to live in it, you know, that we have a land that is that we understand to be entrusted in our care, that we can use to our benefit, but also ensure that our grandchildren benefit from it as well.
Let me remind our listeners that we're talking with Diane Benson, who's running for the U.S. House of Representatives, and learn more about Diane at www.bensonforcongress.com, BensonForCongress.com. Diane, I'm going to give you an opportunity to tell the listeners anything you would like them to know further about you, why they should vote for you. Mm. We've covered a lot of ground today.
This is a time where we make it or break it. And I feel strongly that as women are able to pick up the torch, they can help move this nation forward, particularly if they are women who really understand the struggles of the average person in this country and are able to articulate that and fight in Congress for those people. I think that we are at a turning point here, even though it's a long path because of what we've experienced over the past 8 years. To get us out of war and into diplomacy, back on that road to diplomacy, to get us out of this energy crisis and into renewables and the pathway of renewables and the economy of green technology, that we move our families forward in, through health care that is available to particularly all the children, first and foremost, and for families, that we are able to stand up for the small businesses instead of watch them die in this country, that we not allow certain multinational corporate interests to be over the law, but to be under the law. And I come from background, a multifaceted background, I suppose, whether it's been driving trucks or commercial fishing in Bristol Bay, like I did one summer, working in the theater and the arts, to writing and teaching kids, so-called at-risk kids, who were pretty much considered lost and watching them thrive. I like to watch communities thrive, and I like to be part of what helps them to survive and to thrive, and that's what our nation needs to do right now.
I want to thank you for being with us, and
thank you.
We will keep an eye on your campaign and the election.
and that we have a real shot at it because, you know, our incumbent is under investigation and we have a lot of people in the race. I have the advantage of having run in 2006, and all I need is people to get out there and make contributions in support of a very progressive candidate for Alaska.
That was U.S. House Representative Hopeful Diane Benson. You can reach Diane at www.bensonforcongress.com.
I realized quickly when I knew I should that the world was made up of this brotherhood of man. For whatever that means. Into a crisis times when I'm lying in bed just to get it all out.
Also on the phone with us from Washington State today is Mark Canham, the father of Dustin and Mitch Canham. Mark's son Mitch is a talented athlete and baseball prospect with the San Diego Padres. 3 years ago, Mark's other son, Dustin Canham, deployed with the U.S. Marine Corps to Djibouti, a small African country on the Gulf of Aden and north of Somalia. I asked Mark to describe what happened.
Dustin was in his third year. On his second deployment, they went off to Djibouti, Africa, on a peacekeeping mission. What was it, 5 days into it on an Easter Sunday? Two Marines showed up at my house to tell me my son had passed on, and
5 days after he was deployed.
Yes, 5 days into there, there hasn't been a shot fired there yet.
Uh-huh.
I mean, they're on their way home next month. I've been invited to go visit with all his friends coming back home, but obviously he's not coming back home. But to get into the story of what happened, I mean, Dustin—they told me that Dustin was just doing a light workout in his tent, in an air-conditioned tent, and he collapsed and died. And right off the bat, that hit me wrong because my son's been working out since he was probably in fifth grade. And he runs every day, lifts weights, stuff like that. And to just do a light little workout and collapse was beyond my belief. I knew something was fishy. Dustin was just a good kid, never did, you know, no drugs, no alcohol, saved himself for his wife. He'd been married like a year and a half.
So he was in his early 20s?
He was 22. I knew something was wrong, and when we had his memorial service, I had someone come up to me and tell me that, you know, who did this to my son that he would kill, and I didn't get into it because I had this service to go to. So I went through the service, and then I looked out for the guy after it, and he didn't have anything to say to me. I noticed during the service that there were some other Marines who were talking to him, and just a lot of weird things happened. One of the Marines that was supposed to follow my son's body all the way home was detained in Germany, which you don't do. You know, you don't take away the Marine from the body. And he was debriefed. The way the Marine Corps handled their investigation, I didn't get their paperwork for 4 months, but yet the paperwork was done in 2 weeks. The colonel over there, in charge of everybody over there, put an article out in the, it's called The Guardian, and said that Dustin had died from a heart attack, which when their autopsy wasn't even done, so he's already spreading a rumor of how my son died. They didn't know. I noticed a wound on my son underneath his eye and a small bruise. I didn't look any further because we were having my son cremated, you know, and I spent like 4 hours with him. I pulled his cosmetics off, and I asked the pathologist, which is pretty much the same one who was involved in the Tillmans. And everyone. They, you know, it's the same guy in Dover that does them all.
Oh, really?
It really hit me as a very retarded person, but trying to be that way. They had my son listed as 5'8". My son was taller than me, and I'm 6'1". You know, so right off the bat, there's things wrong. Then one guy says his heart's too big. The other guy says it's too small. They're trying to cover their butt to hide this. His heart was within the parameters, too. It was inside of their limits of what small and large heart is.
So let me go back to when you were sitting with your son for those 4 hours. You said you took off the cosmetics.
During the service, I mean, you know, yeah, open casket. We were looking at him before, and I kind of put on my read glasses, and I saw something. A scar that he had was gone, but I saw something under his eye. So I mentioned to my sister, she goes, no, you're seeing things. But the next day, I spent 4 hours alone with him, and I pulled the cosmetics that they had on him away from him. There was a cut, and there was a small bruise. I asked asked the pathologist about that, and he said it could have happened after. When I talked to him, he didn't have any answers for me for anything. What a joke, you know. And I, how can you bruise afterwards? You don't bruise later. And then I got a copy of the autopsy photographs. My lawyer's looking at them now. But I asked the pathologist. I said, how come he had bruising up and all up and down his torso? Just threw some out. Well, I didn't see the picture. I didn't know if he did or not. I didn't look. And he says, well, those all happened during when they were trying to resuscitate him. I said, on his arms and stuff. Plus, there was blood in the room. There was when the photographs, the 300-page deal that I got back from the Marine Corps, which was a gigantic joke. I mean, it was just the way they interrogate. They ask people about what happened. They just ask them what kind of person my son was. That's all they asked them. They didn't ask about the person, the two people that were in the tent with them. The military did admit that they did wrong. They did in writing. What happened is he was playing around with his friends, and one of them chipped his tooth. A rock chipped one of the kids' tooth, and so instead of just letting it go, they took my son in there, and I know that this one kid involved, the Diaz, Sergeant Diaz, he was a platoon leader, that he lost control.
So there was some sort of incident.
So he was over 100 degrees. They took him in the tent, and this guy I know from, I've got other kids that were with him at Camp Lejeune before that he was just, how the Marine Corps, you get brainwashed, you know. That's one thing I told my son, never lose, you know, your civilians, who you are, and he never did. He was just too nice of a kid, you know, and a lot of people don't like it. And in war, it's a lot different. There was no war going on in Africa. It was a peacekeeping mission. You know, no one's been shot. A gun hasn't even been shot over there. But yet this guy took my son in there, and because my son, people liked my son, except for this guy didn't, because Dust was too nice of a guy. People liked him. So he took him in there. He's pissed off for chipping a guy's tooth, a friend's tooth. And what they said is 2 minutes into doing a couple push-ups that the son Dust rolled over and died. Look, all the generals that I've been talking to, that they're reservists and they're lawyers. I haven't had any help from the government at all whatsoever. I went on Capitol Hill here and met with the Department of Defense, all the governors and senators from this area. They did nothing.
Where are things now? You're still looking to get more information?
My son's platoon gets back next month. They need me to go there. I'm pretty tough. There are a lot of kids who love Dustin, and they've been brainwashed since the time that, you know, Gus died of a heart attack. Died of a heart attack. Well, he didn't. The sad thing about it is you always, before you lose something like this, you think, hey, what would I do in a circumstance like that, you know? There's nothing you can do. I mean, there's no amount of money. There's no, the only thing that would make it right is if I could hold Dust in my arm. Think that they would punish someone when someone murders someone in the military or causes manslaughter or whatever. Instead of just like in the churches when you have someone having indecent liberties with the kids, they move them to another church. It's just the same thing happens in the military. You move them from one position to another. That's what they did with this Diaz. They took him, which he shouldn't have been a platoon leader in the first place, and they put him in the Army. Well, no, they should have kicked him out of the military, and then my lawyer should be able to get him for something, wrongful death or whatever. I don't know. Believe it, that would bring a little bit of solace to my heart, because when I do something wrong, you do something wrong, we're punished. You know, and that's the way the world is. I'm sure God, if there is a God, that this guy will be punished severely. He has to live with him. Here's the thing, too, is ever since this started, all I've asked every general, although there's a Brigadier General Moore, I have a 3-star general in my family, Charles Cannon, now deceased. You know, fought long and hard for this country. We get some backup for what we've done for nothing.
Now, you've also talked with other parents that have been in this situation. I know you've spent some time talking with Mary Tillman about her son.
Oh, what a mess.
Are there any similarities? I mean, clearly her son was in combat.
Everybody's involved in it. It's the same people. Yeah. And it's just, you know, they admit that they've done wrong, but what do they do to the people? I mean, I read the book that Mary wrote, you know, in one night. It angered me because the same crap. I mean, same scenario. Pat, nice guy. I mean, just a nice guy. You get him out there and you get the Marines. A lot of them are convicts, can't even vote. But you put a rifle in their hand, and then they got someone like Pat, who's just a, you know, a nice guy, all-American, got a flag tattooed on his chest, as far as I can shoot, to get away with killing him, you know? And for this lifetime, I don't know. I pray to God that there's something, you know, something happens afterwards. People have to be held accountable. It's not going to get any better. I mean, it's just, there's so many people that I've talked around in this area. I had one friend that I meet. They're my friends because I feel for them. Nobody else knows what it's like until you lose something like that. It's child, this is the only thing worse, I think, is not, you know, missing in action or something, never to see them again and always wondering. I had a guy from Japan that they're doing nothing over there, and they told his family for a year that he committed suicide. They found a bullet in him, you know, and he was thrown off a bridge. I mean, it's just amazing that the things that they're getting away with.
Yeah, there's this whole underbelly of information that just never reaches the public here.
To start, like I was going to say, all these generals, I've asked everybody up till below George Bush to meet this Diaz, to have him tell me the story to my face, okay? I'm not going to beat him or anything. That would just make me as bad as him, you know? That's not what I want. I want the truth. I want to hear him tell me the story. What happened when he walked in the tent? What happened with my son? Okay, if my son did walk into that tent and he had a heart attack, then I'd be good with it because he's with God, you know. If there is God, he's right next to him. He wouldn't let me talk to him. He won't talk to me. So that just makes him guilty as hell to me. I mean, I know where the guy lives. I know I know what he's done all his life.
Diaz, the platoon leader?
Diaz, he's done. And you know, the thing is they interviewed both the kids that were in the tent. And that's Lance Corporal Abril and Sergeant Diaz. And the deal is they're going to stick up for each other. First off, the Marines, they went to boot camp together. These kids, they're, you know what I mean? They're brothers. So you cover each other's butt. I was in the military. I know about that. CYA, cover it. You know, I'm going to find a way to just stay on them. None of it's going to make it any better. I mean, if they would have done something to these two people and held them accountable, that would have been great. But they don't.
Mark, when were you in the military, and what branch were you in?
I was in the Navy, like, forever ago, you know, in the 70s. There was no war going on, and it was just a big joke back then.
At that time, did you get the sense that there was, you just mentioned the CYA part of it?
Oh, that's all, I learned that right off the bat. I mean, even just when I was in the military, I had a friend of mine that got caught with drugs, and they said, you can do 5 years in prison, or you can do 5 years in the military, and you stay out of trouble, you're fine. And that's back then, you know, and it's even getting worse now from what I hear. And, you know, the hardest part, too, is that I heard, like, in the Marine Corps that, you know, they weren't beating on people anymore and stuff, but it's so rampant. They cover you, as long as you're in the military, the military will cover you. They'll take care of you, they'll hide everything from you. The day you get out, then they quit covering you. That's the same way it was for me. I mean, I had some issues. When I got out of the military, they were right back there, but the whole time I was in, for 2.5 years that I was in, I was in no trouble. They guarded me, you know, and you could get away with a lot of stuff. I don't know what the deal is. I don't know how we're going to change it. I look for every day a way that we can get people to realize what's going on. You know, unless it's happened to you, people really don't.
At the same time, we've seen some real courage around some of the military leaders. Taguba, for example, he talked about what happened at Abu Ghraib and said that the leaders of the military that were involved in that should be held accountable. They never have been. And for speaking out in that way, Taguba himself was forcibly retired.
See how it works? Yeah, but you know what? That's honorable. That's the way I look at the Marine Corps. I mean, I look at the uniforms, I look at the way they move and stuff, and I go, what an honorable situation. And I finally was good with my son being a Marine, and then this happened. But he got out the honorable way. He cleared his conscience. He told the truth. I had a Brigadier General Moore tell me, hey, you know, Mark, what I want to do is be able to look you in the eye and tell you the truth. So he can never do that. It's just, how can these people live? They must not believe in God. They must not have any morals, you know, they put it under the heading that it's war.
Well, at the same time, I mean, let's think about it from their point of view. If they speak out, they get retired. How do they make a living for their families? I mean,
yeah, but that's okay. How do you live with yourself when you lied? The thing is all these senators, I mean, even the president, you know, the vice president, if their kid was there and this happened to them, it'd be a totally different story.
In some ways, again, I come back to the belief that I have that our system itself is actually broken. The military is a huge generator of income for the United States, for people that are involved in it. And it's very difficult then to challenge that system, isn't it?
Well, it's like my lawyer said. He says they have an unlimited fund, you know. The thing is the money that they gave me when my son passed away, I wish they would have gave me more, then I could fight him longer. Because that's all it is. I mean, we put it in CDs and stuff, and the interest is going to go to pay my lawyer from here until whenever I die. We're just going to keep on kicking them until they tell the truth. I'm expected to tell the truth and do what's right in my life, and why the hell don't they, you know, if I'm American, are they American?
Now, how is your other son doing?
He's like me. He's just walking around in hell. You find a way to hide it. I mean, he's doing all right, you know, but he's stuck in the baseball. That's his love of his life is playing baseball. I mean, you know, and when I asked him, like, after the services, I went straight back and kind of looked like Lou Gehrig, you know, falling over.
Hmm. Is he younger than Dustin?
He's a year older than me. I mean, they were joined together at the hip. Their mom passed away, like, you know, five, six years ago, and it was us three. So they were very, very close. And he lost his mom. That was tough, but just losing his brother, I mean, it's like someone cut both his legs off and he's trying to run. He's doing all right. I mean, he's one tough kid, but I don't know.
Let me ask you this. I mean, it would seem to me that something like this really breaks your trust in the country that you live in.
Yeah, listen to the national anthem. I used to be proud of it. I just, yeah, you know. But I work at a T-shirt company. You know, I've got one that I wear around and people love it. It says, "Hey, Genie, why don't you take Bush on?" You know, I mean, it's just, I don't want bad to anybody. I just want people to be accountable. Your first thought when my son died is to find out that I told the general I want the person who did this gone, you know, the next day. That's the kind of person I am, but I have trouble with anything to do with America right now. I mean, if we're in another country, they'd just tell me to shut up and cut my head off or something, you know. I mean, our country is one of the best. I've lost a lot of faith in it. I just want to live in my own little space and everybody stay away. I don't want, no recruiters are allowed on my property. I'm not threatening them. I'm just, stay the hell away from me. We can recruit our kids. See, that's our problem, too, is all these kids, my son, I could have told him this stuff could have happened, and I think I did. And I had a bad feeling about it, but I'm sure every parent does when their kid goes off, is that they feed on these kids coming out of high school that they want to be, you know, proud for their country and stuff. And that's a great thing, but they're just a number. Man, just like back in Vietnam, you know, body count, that's it. I mean, what is it? You're just a number? Is that all you are? My son was way more than a number. My son was a great person. And for him to be taken and then just like, hey, here's money and move on, deal with it. I mean, have you dealt with any with like the NCIS, the JAG unit? Unbelievable. What a joke that is.
Talk about that a little.
Oh, I mean, they never gave me any answers, anything. I talked with them. I had questions. And she goes, they moved me up higher. One lady wanted to, I asked for a supervisor, and she goes, why do you want me a supervisor? I go, well, you haven't answered any of my questions. Why should I answer that one question you asked me? So I finally get a supervisor, and she goes, well, just give me a question of concern. And I gave them all to her, and she never answered them for 4 months. And then they started to act like I was the one that was on trial here.
Mm.
You know, it's just, I watched them. I asked the lady, too, I don't mention her name, but I just asked the lady, I said, you know, I watched your like once or twice, and I thought maybe you guys were really good at your job, but basically I think there's more of a market for you in the fast food industry, you know. They don't like me, and I mean, it's just, and now, like the Marine Corps, they're done. Once they give you your little book of garbage, like the blood all over in my son's room, I asked them, why was there blood all over the room? Well, they said for an IV, and I said, what, you plug it into and shot around the room? You know, they just want to cover their butt. All it is.
What does your lawyer say?
He's just getting into it because we were waiting for NCIS, and NCIS still hasn't given me their little story, which will be the same as the Marine Corps. I mean, it's just my son, Mitch, has lost all faith in the whole thing. I apologize to him just today because I kept on thinking that, you know, in this world, we're going to get it right. Someone did wrong here, and they're going to be accountable. But no, it's like, you know, and he just laughs at me. He's wasting his time. But my lawyer is just gonna start a tornado. I mean, there's a lot of other things we're gonna bring up that I haven't brought up yet. I find like I've had headaches for the last 5 months. I'm not whining or anything. I haven't slept. I don't eat right, you know. And I'm trying to get answers. And so they tried to medicate me some, and that didn't work at all. I'm gonna try and get it out to the public. I'm gonna find a way.
That was Mark Canham describing his experience with the U.S. Marine Corps and trying to learn what really happened to his son, Dustin Canham, during a U.S. peacekeeping tour in Djibouti. That's our show for today. The music you heard is from Four Non-Blondes and What's Up. As always, you're invited to email me at susan@raisingsandradio.org and suggest shows you'd like to hear in the future. That's susan@raisingsandradio.org. You can also go to our website, www.raisingsandradio.org. Thanks for listening to Raising Sand Radio today on KZSU Stanford FM 90.1. We'll go out again with Four Non-Blondes and What's Up.
My life is still trying to get up that great big hill of hope for a destination. I realized quickly when I knew I should that the world was made up of this brotherhood of man, for whatever that means, into a crisis.